Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Molly Marin. I am the webinar coordinator for the New York State RTI Technical Assistance Center. We're very glad to have you online with us today. We have Dr. Shapiro back again for another webinar on the database decision-making in the RTI process. Today's PowerPoint, as well as a number of handouts, are available on our webpage. One of the handouts is an Excel file that I was unable to post to the webpage, so I will email it out to those who attend today. Just so you know, watch for that. And if you don't see it, you can always email me, but I will be sending it out later today or tomorrow morning. Also, at the end of today's presentation, we will have a link to a brief evaluation. If you could please take a few minutes to complete that, we very much appreciate the feedback. Also, throughout the webinar today, please use the chat box for any questions or comments that you may have. Dr. Shapiro will take time, likely at the end, to answer your questions. We'll have plenty of time for questions, so please use that. As I said, today is the second webinar in our database decision-making in an RTI process strand. Webinar 3 will take place next Monday, December 15th, and the fourth webinar will take place in January, January 12th. We also have one more webinar in our math series, which is tomorrow. All information on registration information can be found on our webpage. We are very pleased to have Dr. Shapiro back with us today. He is currently a professor of school psychology and director for the Center for Promoting Research to Practice in the College of Education at Lehigh University, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. He is the 2006 winner of the Senior Scientist Award given by the Division of School Psychology of the American Psychological Association in recognition of senior member of the field who has provided a sustained program of outstanding theoretical research. He is author, co-author, and co-editor of 16 books, including his most recently published text with Joseph Kowalski and Amanda Vanderhayden. The RTI Approach to Evaluating Learning Disabilities. Dr. Shapiro is best known for his work in curriculum-based assessment and methods for assessing and intervening in academic skills problems with elementary-age students. Among his many projects, Dr. Shapiro recently received his second U.S. Department of Education training grant to train school psychologists as facilitators of the RTI processes. Over the past decade, Dr. Shapiro has been working as a consultant with the Pennsylvania Department of Education to facilitate the implementation of the response to intervention methodology for the state. And at this time, I welcome Dr. Shapiro.
Thank you so much, Molly, and good afternoon to everyone on the webinar. Looking forward to a very active session today. I want to reiterate to everyone that these sessions are connected. So my assumption is that you attended at least last week's webinar, or at least you had a chance to listen to it. And if you hadn't, I would suggest before you get to the next webinar that you do get a chance to go back and at least listen to the first one, because it was setting up everything else we're going to do today and next week, and then again in the January session. So today, what I'm going to be really focusing in on is an aspect of something that I mentioned last week, and this has to do with key decisions when you're using universal screening data. And in particular, we're going to be focusing in very much on the process of goal setting with benchmark data, with an emphasis here on the kinds of ways in which we set goals for the grade and the group kind of goals that are relevant for how we expect our kids to shift and our schools' grades to shift from one level of benchmark performance at the beginning of the year to the middle of the year to the end of the year. I'm going to go through some pretty detailed efforts on how you actually determine these goals with the methodology that we've been using both here in Pennsylvania and around the country in places that I've worked with that has worked very well, and it seems to be a good strategy for how you do an empirically based approach to setting these kind of goals. I'm also going to talk about the instructional decisions for core instruction, which is what setting these goals are all about, and that is we set these goals and then we end up having to recognize that if we're going to be doing something at the core instruction level, our teachers need to look at core instruction, decide what as a group, as a grade level, they want to implement as a uniform group across all of our core instruction processes to try to get the group of students to shift and move from one level of performance to another across the year. So those are the three big things that I'm going to be covering for today. just as a reminder, again and again and again, I think this is a theme that, of course, resonates with myself and resonates with those of us that always talk about RTI, and that is that without data, it's only an opinion. So our objective here is to consistently make our data-based-driven decisions. To reiterate again, we're all about the data, and we're all about talking to our teams within the schools, and in particular, the core team and the grade-level teams. It's important to remember to always follow the script, and the script we talked about last week, and those scripts should be something that you always have with you when you're going to be making those kinds of decisions and having a grade-level team meeting or a core team meeting. Keep to the time limits and make sure everyone follows their particular role. We move from grade level to individual level decisions, and today we will focus again predominantly on grade level decisions. And finally, we keep the meeting focused on instruction, and we avoid other distractions during the meetings, and we always end these meetings with a purpose and a summary. These were the steps we laid out last time during the meeting, and we started by recognizing we have these district-provided data sets, and we identify the current performance of grade levels, and we set measurable goals. And this is where we're going to be spending the majority of our time today, and that is, how do we set these goals, and what is the process we use to set those goals? And once we set them, identifying research-based instructional strategies that can be broadly applied across the grade levels to select which strategies we want our teachers to implement as a group, plan the logistics of those strategies, identify finally which students might need more frequent assessment, that is, which students are we looking for Tier 2 or Tier 3 level instruction, and set our next meeting date. So we start with our fall benchmark data, and as I reiterated last time, the fall benchmark data identifies the percentage of students who have attained the skill or established or are at low risk. All of those terms are used synonymously here. What percentage of our students are developing the skill, are emerging, or are at some risk? Again, all those terms are synonymous. And how many students or what percentage of those students are deficient or are at risk in this particular skill? And this begins the beginning of our meeting, and that's the very first step of our meeting process, and we identify those things. The next step is now we need to set and identify, after we've identified how our students are doing, and we summarize these elements on the SERF form or some other similar form. And just as a reminder, Molly, would you put this SERF generic form up for just a second here? This is the form that I keep referring to when I talk about the SERF form, and it's one of the forms that one could use to document how indeed you're doing. So here, this SERF form has the target skill, which is the percentage of students who are at the proficient level based on that particular standard or benchmark, and then we put our goal down here and our strategy selected for this quarter. So this is the form that I keep referring to, the logistics, and we'll come back to this form again and again throughout the time, and then we get into Tier 2 and Tier 3 a little later. But this first page of the form is what we're talking about right now, and that is very simply, we record and we actually document what are the percentage of our students currently at the benchmark level, what student percentage are at some risk, what percentage are at low risk. All right, let's push that aside for now. But that's the form you want to refer to when you're talking about this process. So one of the things we always look at, of course, is we start by looking at how our students are doing. This is an example of a histogram that demonstrates in this particular grade level, we have 66% of our students at low risk, 24% at some risk, and 10% at risk. Again, this is our starting point. Now we start by talking about how we set the measurable goals. And I'm going to walk through this in a fairly slow and deliberate fashion so you can follow the calculation, how it's done, why it's done the way it is, and what its final outcomes are going to be like. The idea here is to create a brief statement that establishes what the expectations are for the group of students. And we talk about a group here at the grade level. So this is at each grade level, we would set this particular goal. And we would set it at this point, for example, on oral reading fluency. Now, if we were working with first grade students, we might have to set a goal specific for nonsense word fluency. We might have to set a goal for initial sound fluency. Depending on what our metric is, we would set the goal around that measure. But I'm going to be talking about it for oral reading fluency, and I'm going to do a worked example that works through second grade. So I'm going to be doing a worked example through second grade here. When we set this goal, at the end of this goal setting process, we will have a goal set in terms of the percentage of students that are going to make progress toward the identified benchmark. And that is, we're going to establish the percentage of students that we expect to now be a benchmark at our next benchmark period. So if this is the fall, the next benchmark period would be winter. We would want to know what percentage of our students do we expect us to be at the fall data point. And we record this on the SERF form. So this is recorded on the SERF form. We just don't say it, we record it. We write it down, and then we're going to use this, of course, against what actually happens when we get to our winter meeting. Now, the goal-setting process is an interesting process. In the earlier days of doing the RTI model, we used it when we did this process with our teams, we would say to our teams, okay, here's where you're at now. So you're at 60% of your kids or 65% of your kids at benchmark in the fall. What do you think you should get to by the middle of the year? Well, many teams are taught in RTI that the objective at the end of the day is to have 80% of your kids at tier one, 15% at tier two, and 5% at tier three. That's our aspirational goals. However, the realities are that while those are aspirational, it all has to do with what your baseline is. What's your starting point? If you're starting at a goal of only 50% of your kids or 55% of your kids at benchmark, getting to 80% is quite a feat and quite an accomplishment if you can accomplish it. So the question is, if we simply left it up to teams to make a decision, sort of a gut-level decision, 90% of the time, teams would pick 80% as their goal. That's what they were supposed to get to. That's what they would pick, regardless of the level that they were starting at. And being realistic, that is just not always a very realistic way of doing this. Recently, I was in a school district that made an arbitrary decision that they were going to move 50% of their kids at the benchmark period, at the fall. They're going to move 50% of their kids who are at some risk to low risk and 50% of their kids who are at risk to some risk. That's not a bad strategy. It's a simple way to do it. You pick half the kids, and that's what you end up setting as your goal. And that worked in these particular schools because they were starting at a fairly high baseline. They were starting at 75 or even close to 80% at the beginning of the year. But when I walked into a school that was starting at 50%, when I looked at what they were doing, to get 50% of their kids moving is a very, very major accomplishment and might be a goal that's really out of bounds for what one should pick. So what we've tried to do is come up with a goal-setting strategy that's empirically based, a goal-setting strategy that has some basis to it in terms of understanding what typical performance of students is about. So I'm going to start and walk through this goal-setting strategy with benchmark data and take everyone through very carefully and very slowly what this process is about. Now, in order to do this, you have to start with two things. The first thing you have to have is you have to have building data with either a histogram or student list formats. My preference actually is to have a student list format over the histogram. The histogram is a good picture of what happens over time, but the student list formats is what I really need to do this well and to do it right and to do it easily. And student list formats are simply, as you'll see, that just lists the students in your case, by name. In my case, of course, I wouldn't identify by names, and their scores. And it's usually placed from low to high scores. You also need a norm table from the assessment system you're using, whether it's Dibbles Next or AIMSWeb or STAR. And I mention STAR specifically here because it's a computer-adapted test. And I know from my work in New York State there are some schools that are using computer-adapted tests. And computer, you can use a computer-adapted test to do this kind of process. All that that you have to have for this process to work is a norm table that tells you that what the growth rate of typical performing students is between the fall, the winter, and the spring of a school year. So here's a histogram, for example. This is a initial sound fluency. It's a fairly old, based on Dibble's sixth edition, I believe. But it's initial sound fluency, and it shows you a histogram, and it shows you in a very nice picture the kids in the green, kids at low risk, kids in yellow, kids at some risk, and finally kids at risk. And you can see this is a frequency, and this is a fairly large school district. There's large grade. We're talking 90 kids here that were actually at some level of risk in just the 20 to 24 numbers. But you can see this is a fairly large number of kids in this particular school. There's a very, very large particular school population. Here's our normative data. Now, the normative data here, as you can see, this is from Dibble's Next. This is a abstracted from their own data sources. And you can see that they have, it tells you what the benchmark is for fall, winter, and spring. And what the rate of improvement is for the typical performing student. Now, typical rate of improvement is very simply the spring benchmark subtracted from the fall benchmark and divided by 36 weeks, 36 weeks being the standard school year for the majority of school districts in the United States. If you take the 87, subtract the 52, and divide by 36, you get 0.97, and that represents the words correct per minute per week that one would expect a student who starts at benchmark in the fall, ends at benchmark in the spring would achieve. Keep in mind that it's very important to keep in mind when you talk about benchmarks that a benchmark is the floor level we would expect of student performance. It's the floor level. We would really hope that the majority of our students achieve above the benchmark level. But what we use is we use the benchmark levels as our cut scores to represent the lowest level of acceptable performance that predicts success in the subsequent benchmark period. So for Dibble's Next, this would be the kind of chart we would use. If you're using AIMSWeb, these are taken from the AIMSWeb normative database, and you can see their database is very large. 38,282 students in their current database. And for second grade, I just outputted first and second grade here, and I only outputted on this chart the percentiles to represent the 10th, 25th, 50th, 75th, and 90th. And if that's all you have, then I would typically use the 50th percentile. But I do want to point out here that how different these scores are from the Dibble's Next scores. So in Dibble's Next, The benchmarks are 52, 72, 82, with a typical ROI for second grade of 0.97. For AIMSWeb, at the 50th percentile, which most people tend to use, it's 62, 88, 106, far higher for second grade, with a 1.22 words correct per minute rate of improvement. You can see that's very much higher. If you're using AIMSWeb and you want to look for something comparable to Dibble's, what you need to do is you need to go through the expanded norms for AIMSWeb. And when you do that, you can get expanded norms for the percentiles at every single percentile. And when you do that, if you take a look here, the percentiles around the 40th percentile for Dibble's, 53, 80, and 96, 1.19, still a little bit higher rate of improvement, are about the same, essentially, about the same, close to it, as where the Dibble's Next is. But you would want to use something that you're comfortable and confident with, whether it's the 50th percentile or it represents the 40th percentile. Whatever you decide to use as a group, that's the percentile that you would want to use essentially in your area. And I will slow down a little bit. If I have a request to slow down, I will slow down. So let me go back through that again so you can be clear about it. So what you have here are the Dibbles NICS benchmarks. These are benchmarks that come from the Dibbles NICS data source. It tells you the fall, winter, and spring benchmark scores, and it's 0.97. And all that is, again, is subtracting the spring score from the fall score, divide by 36, that's the number of weeks that is in a school year, and you end up with 0.97 words correct per minute per week. That's what a typical performing student would do if they were at benchmark across the year. We call that the typical rate of improvement. You can, if you're using AmesWeb and you use the 50th percentile, these would be the scores you would use. If you want to use something less than the 50th percentile for AmesWeb, you can go into the AmesWeb database, click on their expanded opportunities for data, and you can get every percentile there is. This is for second grade, and you could pick whatever percentile you were comfortable with selecting. If you were using STAR or using a computer adapted test, you can do the same thing. Here we have STAR. If you look at STAR and you look at the 40th percentile for STAR, it's a scaled score of 166 in the fall, 299 in the spring, with a growth rate of 4.0 standard score points per week. And again, we could use any of those values to do this analysis. I'm going to be showing you this analysis and do the worked example essentially using STAR. All right, excuse me, using Dibbles NICS. My mistake, Dibbles NICS. Why do we want to do this? What are we trying to accomplish by doing this? What we want to happen is we want to push the pile of students that we have towards benchmark by the end of the year. We want to move as many students as we can from the fall to the winter to the spring to the benchmark levels. And we want to do that without losing any of our current students who are at the benchmark level. So we don't want to lose any students across the year. We want to maintain all of our students that we start at benchmark levels, and we want to push the pile of students towards the benchmarks by the end of the year. So we set goals to achieve that. On the slide, by the way, it looks like my percent sign somehow got converted to a row. These are percent signs. The percentage of students that will move from strategic to benchmark, the percentage that will move from some risk to low risk, and the percentage that will move from intensive to strategic, at risk to some risk. Remember, we are looking at groups of students at each grade level, not at who the individual students will be at this point. So our objective is about the group of students and pushing the pile from some risk to benchmark, low risk, and from at risk to some risk. All right, so let me walk you through this multi-step process, one step at a time. One of the forms that you have available to you over here is called the Goal Setting Cheat Sheet. Molly, if you could put that up for a minute. And I don't suggest you do this now, but the process I'm going to take you through, one step at a time, is outlined in this simple cheat sheet for going from strategic to benchmark. That is, when you're trying to set goals from some risk to low risk, strategic to benchmark, this is the process you will use. I'm going to walk you through it one step at a time on the PowerPoint slides. I'm going to use a worked example of a second grader in this process. You can obviously change the grade, you can change the rate of improvement, you can change the multiplier. And at the end of this, I also will share with you a little wizard that we've created, that's the Excel spreadsheet that Molly's going to send to everybody, that will take you through this process. but I want to do it by hand first so you understand how this process works. Okay, let's go back to the PowerPoint. Thanks, Molly. Okay, so first step. The first step is we have to determine the typical rate of improvement. What is the typical rate of improvement? Now, let me, we're going to use Dibbles Next as our example, and we're going to be using a second grader at Dibbles Next. And in order to select the typical rate of improvement here, we would use the rate of improvement for that grade level that's used by that measure. So if you recall, a couple of slides ago, I showed you these rates of improvements here. Here's the Ames Web version, and here's Dibbles Next. So we're going to be using this 0.97 for Dibbles Next. One of the handouts that I have for you, not to confuse you much, but I do want to point it out to you, the one called Dibbles Next ROI. Would you put that up, please, Molly? This particular handout you'll need to take a good look at for a bit because it's a little complicated. One of the things you have to know about using rate of improvement and you're using Dibbles Next is you can't do rate of improvement with Dibbles Next if you're using the composite scores unless it's a point when all of the measures, all of the assessments are the same at every point in time. And if you scroll down on this one, you can see right here, stop right there, these are the composite scores. So if you're using composite scores for Dibbles Next for rate of improvement, you have to be at grade 3, 4, 5, 6 to use that. And that's because those are the only grades in which all the measures are the same. Scroll down a little further, please. However, if you want to look at individual measures for Dibbles Next, here they are. And that is the Dibbles Next measures are indicated here for the fall, the winter, and the spring. They're considered fall, winter, spring also for strategic. And here is the rate of improvement. So this is a handout that you could certainly spend a little more time on, but this is a handout available to you to lay out and get you an idea what the rate of improvement is for the Dibbles Next. You can close that up, Molly. For now, I think you can use the PowerPoint slide that I provided for you, which is really the simplest version of this. And again, it's based on specific measures rather than the composite scores. Okay. So let's move forward here. And start by, this is now rate of improvement. And again, you can use the 50th percentile. You could also use a different percentile if you wish to do that. But for the example, we're going to use Dibbles Next. The example I'm showing will work the same if you're using Ames Web, STAR, or any other measure with normative growth between fall, winter, and spring. That's the key. You have to have normative growth for fall, winter, and spring for the grade level. So, we're going to use Dibbles Next, not the composite, and here it is, the Dibbles Next scores for second grade. 52 in the fall, 72 in winter, 87 in spring, with a year rate of improvement of 0.97. You'll see there's also a fall to winter ROI and winter to spring ROI listed here. I'll talk much more about that in the last webinar, why those numbers are there and what those numbers mean. But for now, we're going to pay attention to the 0.97 as the year-long rate of improvement that we have for students. So that is our typical rate of improvement, and that's our first step in the process. The next step is to determine what we call the target rate of improvement. Now, the target rate of improvement is the rate of improvement that our target students would want to make, that is the group of students would want to get to if they were going to achieve benchmark by the next period of time. Now, remember, we're looking at all students here who are below the benchmark. These are all students at the some risk category, or the strategic level, depending on what you call it, but all in that same group. We need those students in order to achieve the benchmark. They have to move at a rate faster than the typical performing student. If those students move at the same rate of improvement as the typical performing students move, they're going to not catch up. They're not going to close the gap. What we're looking for here is sometimes called catch-up growth, and that is the acceleration of their performance above what their typical performing students are doing. In order to do this, we use a multiplier of the typical performing student, and the value we pick is somewhere between 1.5 to 2.0. If we pick 1.5, that's probably a conservative estimate. That's probably a minimal level. That's accelerating the rate of growth by 50% over what typical performing students are doing. If we double the rate of improvement, that's ambitious. That would be a very ambitious level. And that would be probably the upper level of what we probably could be able to do with our students. How do we decide whether we use a conservative value or an ambitious level? Well, this is where your team gets together and makes a decision. You need to look at how far below your target students are. If I'm looking at a distribution where I have a high group of students who are really bunched just below my benchmark, I would probably pick an ambitious level. Hey, I think I can do that. I think we can move all these kids above that level at that kind of rate. If I have a distribution where I have a high percentage of kids that are really spread out in that some risk category, I might pick a more conservative value in my initial selection here. Teams will get confident and comfortable with what they think they can accomplish. I think it's wonderful that teams will be ambitious and try to accomplish more than they might think they can do initially, but I think it's also important to be realistic. So remember, the reason we multiply here, again, to reiterate this, is we need to move this group of students who are below the benchmark, we need to move them faster, accelerate what a typical performing student who is at the benchmark would do. This is why we call it the target rate of improvement. For all the examples we're going to use here, we're going to use the 1.5 multiplier. So we're going to use the conservative multiplier here as our example. Again, you could use a much more ambitious one if you'd like. You can move something in between. But we're using the conservative the ambitious one. I'm going to use the conservative value in the examples. Okay, so how do we calculate the target rate of improvement? Fairly simple. We multiply the typical rate of improvement, it says average, the typical rate of improvement by 1.5. Remember, the typical rate of improvement was 0.97. We multiply that by 1.5. And that gives us a value of 1.46. What that says then is if typical students who move at benchmark rates move at a rate of 0.97 words correct per minute per week, our plan for students below the benchmark in that some risk category are to move them and accelerate their progress at 1.46 words correct per minute per week. And that value would be placed on our form if you'd like. You could see that form. You could put that on the form as the next value. That's considered the target rate of improvement. Okay. Step 3. This step involves determining the expected gain. So how many words does that really translate to? Now, the typical benchmark period is 18 weeks, fall to winter or winter to spring. That's the typical benchmark period. I'm very aware that schools don't usually do their fall benchmarks until maybe their first or second or third week of school in the year. And some schools do their mid-year benchmarks very early. So there may only be 10 or 11 or 12 weeks between those period of time. We're going to use 18 weeks as our number here, and I would recommend using 18 weeks as a general guideline, even if we're using fewer than 18 weeks as our actual number of weeks to mid-year. I would typically use 18 weeks. I think that's a fair thing to do. You may be off by a week or two on one end or the other, but 18 weeks is typically what we recommend as a half a school year. So we calculate what's called the expected gain. The expected gain occurs, very simply, by multiplying the expected rate of improvement times the number of weeks to the next benchmark period. So, in second grade, the targeted rate of improvement was 1.46 times 18 weeks, which is 26.3 as a number, and we round that, in this case, to 26. So, we expect over 18 weeks, the target students, who are those students in that some risk category, to gain 26 words correct per minute over that 18 weeks, to gain 26 words over 18 weeks. That's what we expect those students to accomplish. All right. So we calculate the cutoff score. And remember, the typical benchmark time is 18 weeks, fall to winter, winter to spring. I see this is actually in lighter font. That probably can be placed into a black font when you get the slides. But as we remind ourselves, the typical benchmark period is 18 weeks, fall to winter, winter to spring. We're going to do what's called the calculate the cutoff score. So what the cutoff score is now we're going to determine how many students will get to the benchmark at the next benchmark period that we collect data. What number of students are going to accomplish that if they gain the number of words that we've now established as our expected gain? Now, one of the things we really remind ourselves of here is we expect all the students who started at benchmark, at the fall benchmark period, to still be there at the middle of the year. We hope we don't lose a single one of those kids. If they were at benchmark in the fall, they should be at benchmark at winter. What we want to do is we want to figure out how many additional students can I add to that benchmark pile. And that group is what will be, by using this expected gain score, that will be the important number that we will use essentially to determine what our percentage of goal will be for the next benchmark period. So to calculate this number, we need to find a cutoff score, and we can do this a couple of ways. We can subtract the benchmark score for the next assessment period from the expected growth score. So in the winter, we would have expected 72 to be the benchmark score. 72 is a benchmark score. We expect that in winter. And we recall we would have expected the students to gain 26 words over that period of time. So the cutoff score is the subtraction of those two numbers, or 46. 46 becomes the cutoff score. Let me go over that again, because that's a very important calculation that you understand. So we're going to calculate this number, and what we're calculating essentially are the number of students that will gain 26 words. If they gain 26 words, how many students does that represent from the group that's in the fall benchmark period? How many does that represent? We calculate that simply. We take the winter score, we subtract the 26, our expected gain, we get a score of 46. Now we have to find out how many students that is. And we do that by counting the number of students from the cutoff score. Again, I apologize. I should have changed this to a black font, but it is in a very light font here. It says count the number of students from the cutoff score, and it'll become evident when I show you how you do this. So how many students would this be that represent this magic number, if you will? I wouldn't call it magic. It's the number of students we're trying to actually move. So we determine the number of students who are at this strategic or this some risk level who are reading at or above the cutoff score calculated in the previous step. So here's an example. So here's a group of students. Here's 44 students from a classroom that represent students. The fall percentage of kids at low risk was 61%, at some risk was 30%, at risk was 9%. Not a bad starting point. Would like it to be higher, but it's not a bad starting point. So, the cutoff score was 46. These represent, remember, the fall data. 52 was the benchmark for the fall. There are six students, 6 students between the cutoff score and 52, which was the benchmark score for the fall. So there are 6 students that represent that group of students. The cutoff score gives you the starting point in which you then count the number of students plus the number of students already at benchmark. So now what I simply do is I calculate the goal. I count every student with a score above the cutoff to determine the expected benchmark group. Very simply, I convert this to a number, to a percentage calculation. Here's what I do. From the cutoff score of 46, the number of students from that number through the benchmark was 6, and there were 27 students already at benchmark when I started. Let me go back to that again so you can see where I'm taking this from. There were 27 students represented in this group here, the group that goes in the low-risk category. So there were already 27. To that 27, I add the 6 students that I expect to move, and I divide that by the total number of students, in this case was 44, and that gives me 75% as my goal for the benchmark at the winter assessment period. At the fall, I was at 61.4. At winter, I want to be at 75%. This is the process by which I make this kind of calculation. What I'm doing is I'm saying that if I accelerate this group of students who are at some risk by a factor of 1.5 times what a typical performing student would accomplish, I would move to 75% of my pile now achieving the benchmark period at mid-year. So let me, again, let's put that worksheet, that cheat sheet back up here first. And if you scroll down through this cheat sheet, this simply takes you through the exact calculation that I just took you through by hand. Gives you exactly the same results. It's the exact same thing in a step-by-step simple format. Okay, let's close that up. Now what I'm going to show you is this, I'm going to show you this particular calculation tool that we've created. Molly, I'm going to take control here. And I'm hoping everybody can see that. Oh, yeah, it looks like everybody can see this. Okay, I'm going to take you through the same exact calculation once again. So on the spreadsheet, and there are notes on the spreadsheet about how you actually do this. So the rate of improvement was 0.97. As soon as I input that and I tab, notice the expected ROI, 1.46, is calculated for the conservative value and for the upper value. And so is the expected words calculated. The next benchmark goal for the middle of the year was 72, if you recall. That now gives me my magic number cutoffs, or my cut scores, 46 and 37. The number of students who were in my number of students who were at benchmark was 27, if you recall. And for the lower cutoff, there were 6. And for the upper cutoff, there were 9. And the total number of students is 44. And lo and behold, here we go. 75% of my students at the lower, at the conservative end, 82% if I used my 2.0 calculation. This kind of strategic benchmark tool is very, very useful, and it's free to you guys to use. Here's a couple of things about this tool that I need to give you a little warning about. We also set it up for moving from at risk to some risk. However, there are some nuances of the tool here that I don't want to go into today that I would suggest not using the tool for this kind of calculation. There are some other nuances because you're dealing at different kinds of numbers here to make this calculation. So what I would simply do is I would take the 75%. If 75% of my kids move to benchmark and I want to decide what percentage move from high risk or at risk to some risk, I would make an estimate looking at how many I had at risk and how many I thought I could move to some risk looking at the numbers. The second thing I would do here is if you want to reuse this tool, don't save it. You can't save it. If you save it, all these values are going to be locked in. So all I do is I close it, and I don't save the file, and I can reuse it again the next time I open it. The next time I open the same tool, it opens, and it's again for use. So a nice little tool to show. Hope you find it useful. If you have any problems with it, you can certainly email me, and I'd be more than happy to walk you through it again. So I'm going to go back to the PowerPoint again. All right. So that's how we calculate in an empirical way, setting the benchmark goal for the next benchmark period. And you can do this from fall to winter. You could do it again from winter to spring. Once you have that goal in mind, now comes a very, very, very important part of this process. Now you have a group goal, so you have a goal for the entire grade level. With that goal in mind, teachers need to identify strategies to reach that goal. Now these are strategies for core instruction. These are strategies to be done during the core instruction period. Here are some examples that might come up. So as a group, the team may decide that we really need to do much more close reading to achieve deeper comprehension among our students, that's something that we really feel we're not getting. And that, therefore, that's going to be what we're going to attend to as a group. So all the teachers would come up with strategies on how you do that. How do you attend to close reading? What are some of the things you might do to achieve that? Or we decide we really need to attend to vocabulary building, that's really where our problem has been, or at least that's what we think is one of the root causes of why we're not getting as high a level among our students for benchmark performance. So we're going to put together ideas for new vocabulary embedded in stories. What are some of the strategies we might use? So there we might come up with things we're going to do related to our word wall. We're going to have a common word of the week or word of the day. Every one of our teachers are going to use that same word. We're going to use it over and over again. Whenever it comes up during the course of conversation, during core instruction, a little bell is rung or something happens, something interesting, but a strategy that everybody does. A third one might be, we're going to be doing some nonfiction reading in the next period of time. We need to attend to that. What we do here is we come up with the target for what we're going to do and what strategies are going to be used. What are the known strategies to make that done? Those strategies should be based on scientifically validated approaches, things that we know are going to have empirical support, and that's what we then select. And those strategies are identified and placed on the SURF form. They're placed on the SURF form. They're placed on forms for database decision making. They're placed on those forms in ways that we know we've all agreed to these. So we have a documentation, annotation of the ideas. We decide which strategy together. So we try to find one strategy that we all think we can do that's doable. And we talk about what are the logistics of those strategies. And we put them on the SURF form. We identify them clearly as a goal. And that becomes critical and important because the idea, again, is that we get together as a group around those particular strategies. We have to talk about the logistics of doing those strategies, the logistics of implementation. What are they? Are we going to use peer modeling and coaching? Do we use grade-level discourse? Do we need to have some demonstration of those strategies? Do we need some help as teachers for how to do them effectively? Do we need to seek that instructional strategy? Do we need different material that we need to be putting in place? All of those are what we do, and we monitor the use of the strategy. So did we use it? What are the ways we use it? We might create a little checklist for ourselves as teachers, a reminder checklist. It could be a couple of items that we put in front of us when we're teaching our lessons to remind us to be doing those strategies during core instruction. We might have to adapt or create some materials that in order to make that work. And if that's the case, we get together as a group to try to have group efforts so that we're no one person's fully responsible for it. And in particular, we may have some novice teachers among us. We may have new teachers who aren't used to this way of thinking, so they may need some help in how to adapt these kinds of things. Molly, put the SURF form back up again. I keep coming back to this form because we found it to be a very, very valuable form. So you can see here we may put the goal for the next quarter, the percentage of students that we expect to reach proficiency. We then may put the strategies, strategies for implementation and the logistics for those strategies. These things are placed there. Now we're going to move in a little bit, the students identified for Tier 2 and Tier 3. So we do go through this process after we've done our group goals. One of the things we do at our meetings is we want to identify the groupings of students who are going to need Tier 2, Tier 3 instruction, what they might do, the kind of monitoring they're going to do, and then we'll get into their specific goals more next week when we talk about rate of improvement. And we talk about strategies for those groups. That's more of next week's activities. But the SURF form for the first page is really what we're about today, and it's such an important part of this process. And oftentimes, it's part of the process that doesn't get as much attention as we would really hope that it should. Let's go back to the PowerPoint. And just as a point, somebody asked if the spreadsheet would be posted with the formulas intact. They are. The spreadsheet you're going to get has the formulas, I believe. I will double-check that, but I believe the formulas are intact in the spreadsheet you're going to get. Just be careful not to save that spreadsheet with the tool that you're going to have, or you'll end up overwriting the formula. Okay, so what we want to really do is we annotate all of this on the SURF with to-dos, and then we go to this point of identifying which students will need more frequent monitoring. Which are the students that are stalled? which are the students that are deficient. This is where we get into that level of identifying students who are in need of tiered instruction. Let's put the SERF form back up again here, and we'll look at that in some detail. And I'm going to show you an alternative form to the SERF, which I've also used, that you may find very helpful as well. So now we go to the second page of the SERF form, and now what we're looking at here is we know that we have these students after we've done our group goal setting and we've set our grade level goals, we've identified strategies for the grade to work on. We still have these students who are not making a level of progress that we're satisfied with. And this may come up, of course, at the beginning of the school year in the fall. It may also show up after we do a mid-year or a midpoint assessment. Here we identify our group goals, our instructional groupings. And these are going to be grouped, of course, based on instructional needs. And we may have multiple groupings. We may have 2, 3, 4, depending on how many we decide to do. We would identify what additional assessment or monitoring is going to be used for these students. And we'll get into the goals we set for those students, as I said, more next week when we talk about rate of improvement and progress monitoring processes. Scroll down a little further. But we do the same thing with identifying the strategies and the logistics for those groups. Keep going. One's for Tier 2, and then one's for Tier 3. And these, again, are very, very similar things. But the key here is to identify on the SERF form the actual groups, and this helps for us to monitor how things are going. Molly, if you would also now take that one down and put up the forms for database decision-making. Here's an alternative form that I've also used, set of forms that I've used. It's a little different structure, but you may find this helpful. And again, these are all available for you as handouts. In this form, we did this a little differently. We start out by identifying who the attendees are at the meetings. You could scroll down. Those are pretty straightforward things. And we start by identifying here what are the goals. What are the percentage of kids at each of the levels, and we have each of the measures laid out here. Here we included a measure of MAES and measure of ORF. If you're doing retail, you could add that. If you wanted to do the composite, you could put that in here. And again, we set some basic goals, with benchmark being at least greater than 75%, the strategic or the emerging or the sum risk, 15 to 20, and deficit less than 10% or 5%. Keep going. The next thing we did here, this is just what's the goal we set. This is the group goal we set. Again, a broad place you can write that in. The next one is interesting. So what kind of barriers came up in the team's discussion? What were the areas of concern? Did we have enough materials? Did we have enough personnel? Do we need some modeling? Do we need some support? Do we need someone to do fidelity checks? Anything that comes up can be identified here. Keep going down. We might brainstorm some of the ideas here for strategies and supports here as well. And then we record these, of course. What are the strategies, materials, resources? Who's responsible? These are all things we can add to this form. Keep going for the implementation plan. And here, when we're getting to individual students, it says Project MP3. That was the name of the project when we actually did this. You could put the student's name down here, and you could indicate what tier they're currently at. Are they above, near, or below the target? And what is our decision about an individual's? We'll talk more about this next week. Continue raise goal instructional modification. And this is a good form for next week that we'll bring back again. So it's just an alternative approach for doing the same kinds of things like the SERF form. It's a matter of recording and documenting what you're doing. Let's go back to the PowerPoint. So, the last step in the process is always identifying when we will meet again and when we're going to review our progress, looking over the SERF, making sure we annotate our outcomes. And that's the last step on the database decision-making process. Now, of course, between our meetings, we're going to monitor the fidelity of intervention. So whatever interventions we've put in place, those need to be monitored for fidelity. We need to be doing progress monitoring of our students that we've identified for progress monitoring, and we might need to do some fine-tuning of our strategy. When the team meets, very often teams will meet midpoint between a fall and a winter data point. They might meet monthly, they might meet weekly, however you have them set up. That's a place where you can fine-tune this process. And again, it's a group decision-making kind of process. As I said, you identify who goes to Tier 2, who goes to Tier 3, who moves from Tier 2 to Tier 1. This all happens, of course, during that mid-year process. So we'll talk more about this in the subsequent webinars. So that ends this day. I'd be more than happy to answer questions. I don't see any questions that have popped up here. So either I've explained this very, very well, or I have mystified everybody with this process, and it's not really mystical. But if anyone has any specific questions on this, I'd be more than happy to answer those questions. If you want to post those questions now, I'll certainly wait a few minutes for those questions to pop up. As I said, I think this process is fairly straightforward, and I think can be very useful and helpful with teams in setting these kind of group goals. What we will do in next week's webinar, which is a more complicated process, is we're going to cover rate of improvement. And rate of improvement is a very, very critical part to the entire RTI process. It's a critical part of the process, and one that sometimes doesn't get as much attention as other things we do in the RTI process. What I will be really trying to cover in the next webinar is the calculations of rate of improvement, the interpretation of rate of improvement. We'll talk about benchmark rate of improvement. We'll talk about progress monitoring quite a bit. And then, just as a preview, in the last webinar in January, a little bit of time between the two, which I think is healthy to digest this material. The last one, I'll talk about interpretations of data, and I'll talk a little bit about some of the new things we've learned about progress monitoring, some of the nuances of using not using a CBM measure instead of using a computer-adapted measure, and that's what I'm going to be doing. I have one point here. The issue is the ever-changing local assessments and on what is acceptable to the state, and that's something, of course, not in my control. After identifying the group goal, the team would identify strategies. Yes, that is correct. That is exactly how this would work. Okay. I don't see any other questions popping up, and if that's the case, I certainly will hand this back over to Molly, and if questions pop up in the meantime, feel free to forward those questions to me between now and next week's webinar, and I'll be certainly willing to answer any of those questions. So, Molly, I will turn this back to you.
Okay. It did look like a couple of people were typing, so I don't know if we want to wait
a
minute.
Then let me wait. Let me wait then. There are some typing here. I will wait.
Yeah, sometimes it takes a minute for people to
get
there.
Yeah, that's fine. No, we're perfectly fine here.
Great.
Okay, let's see. I got a question. All right, well, here's a question. Someone indicates that they've been using data from the 1993 and 2001 Fuchs and Dino Fuchs and Dino work on realistic rates and ambitious rates. I think that work is fine, and one could certainly use that. I think the data are outdated. I think that there has been substantial efforts since the 93 and 2001 work to really improve the reading performance of kids, and I think we'll be starting at too low of a baseline with that work. I would think that both Dugalin Fuchs and Stan Dino and their work would encourage folks to probably be using more current values that we have. And I think the values that we get from Dibble's Next, the values we get from AIMSWeb, if you're doing a CVM approach here, are good values. Both of those give you large databases that have looked at how kids are doing currently. AIMSWeb in particular annually updates their database. So so that would be my perspective. Here's an interesting question. What do you devise at the high school level where there's no benchmark data? Okay. Let me give you my take a little bit on high school level. First of all, the only place to use a CBM measure at the high school level is with students who are so substantially behind in reading performance that they are performing much like kids in the upper elementary grades or the mid-elementary grades. One of the things we know about oral reading fluency as a measure is oral reading fluency begins to lose its predictability to reading outcomes by about the fourth grade. It's still predictable, it's not unpredictable, but it begins to lose some of the predictability. Because it loses its predictability, you need to be thinking more about reading comprehension and short and vocabulary and other kinds of measures. And I see here that someone has created benchmarks for their high school with reading comp and short and written responses. I think that's outstanding. I think that's the way you go. And if you created something that works and gives you a rate of growth, I think you should share that with everybody because we'd all love to see it. There really is very little out there at the high school level for doing this, but there are some efforts out there occurring in the research world to try to get high school level kind of performance. But I think, as this one individual indicated, they recognize you need to be doing more about comprehension, you need to do things about written response, you need to do things about vocabulary. Oral reading fluency really is measuring nothing but probably oral reading fluency by the time you get to high school. And essentially, if a student reads 130 or 110 or 150 words correct per minute, it's not real important to me. What's really important is how they understand what they read. Good questions, though. And thank you for bringing up that information on the high school level. Gave me a chance to share a little bit of my knowledge related to how oral reading fluency shifts over time. I see someone else is typing a question, so I will wait until that question pops up. Excuse me. Okay.
In the meantime, I'll post the link to the survey so
okay.
Everybody has that.
Yeah, there are a few people typing questions, so I'm going to wait and see if those pop up here. We have a few more minutes to hold off, so I can certainly wait. I see a few people are still typing. Well, I don't see those questions popping up. Okay. Someone asked about STAR. Yes. STAR can be used across the grade levels for both middle and high school students. STAR assessment is a computer-adapted test. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that a little bit next week, but more in January. A computer-adapted test has a very different development process, but you can use the scaled score or that is used in STAR, or if you happen to be using some people I've come across are using the MAP, M-A-P, the MAP tests, some use Scholastic, those can all be used. Another question was about Easy CBM for grades 2 to 8. I think you can use Easy CBM. I think you're referring to probably the comprehension measures for screening. The only issue with the Easy CBM measures is the time it takes to give those. The Easy CBM measures do take comprehension take a longer period of time, and that can get in the way of what you want for a screening measure, but those would possibly be used. Also, someone mentioned they're using iReady computer adaptive assessment. Again, if it's a computer adapted assessment, I'm getting I am assuming that measure could be used. I am not familiar with iReady, and I will take a look at that to now and next week. But iReady, I'm assuming, is a computer adapted test, and if it is, it could be used just like STAR or any other computer adapted test. And I see someone uses the Faltus and Pinnell benchmarks and local assessments. And again, those are good measures to use as supplements. The only issue with Faltus and Pinnell benchmarks is, again, they're local assessments, and they're not really always done as a national kind of database. And STAR measures, the STAR is published benchmarks, cut scores, and growth rates are all available through 12th grade. Somebody asked if they need to use a screener on top of iReady. I would need to learn more about iReady. If iReady is similar to STAR and other kinds of computer-adapted assessments, my sense is you may not need both of those. Some folks use both because they look at they're looking at the oral reading fluency measure as a measure of fluency. So I would really need to learn more myself about iReady. It analyzes all areas of English language arts. And again, it's probably a computer adapted assessment. And if it is, it has a score associated with it, then that would be probably something that might be valuable. I'll take a look at iReady between now and next week, and I will certainly mention that again. It is with scores, okay? Thank you, Rosemary, for your information. Thanks a lot, and I'll look into iReady. But again, if it's iReady is similar to STAR and is similar to NWEA MAP, then those measures can all be used as benchmark measures. Some of those measures can be used as progress monitoring measures. We'll talk more about that in the coming weeks. I want to thank you all very much again. I think it's been a great conversation. And multiple attendees are typing. So let me wait another few more minutes here, Molly. I really want to give everybody a chance to get their questions answered. But this is a great conversation, by the way, about measures other than the CBM measures. Can adaptive measures be used as screeners? If you mean computer-adapted measures, yes. Computer-adaptive measures can be used as screeners. Sure. Actually, Rosemary, thank you. Why don't you send me that? I would love to see it. And you could email it directly to me at my email address, or send it to Molly, and she will get it to me. Okay, I think we're going to bring this to a close. Thank you very, very much for attending. And it sounds like this is a great group, a great conversation here at the end. I'm glad we waited for people to start typing in. Okay, thanks again. Molly, back to you.
Thanks, everyone. I just put the link up to the survey again. If you would please take a few minutes to complete that, we really do appreciate the feedback, and we look at those every week. So I hope you can join us again next week. And looks like Teresa's typing, but have a great night.
Thanks, Molly. Bye-bye. Good night, everybody.